Welcome back to the Green Front, and we are continuing to focus on our favorite topic, climate change, because it is the mother of all eco challenges, the great exacerbator, as Larry Brilliant of formerly of Google Foundation used to say, and I can't forget that term every time I hear it because it seems to be so true. We are seeing that very dramatically this summer in terms of record melting heat temperatures and fires and droughts. And before that, flooding and tornadoes and twisters and hurricanes, oh my. And there was a very dramatic picture in the Wall Street Journal Monday of this week, and we're going to be talking about what is happening that is impacting fish. And, in fact, thousands of fish are dying in the Midwest. This one photo and article, just I have it in front of me. I had to cut it out. It's a picture of a frog sitting on top of a dead fish in a pond near Waterloo, Nebraska last week. And I couldn't help but think that is, sort of with my dark humor, that is the frog that was in the pot of water getting warmer, and it jumped out right before it reached the boiling point. You know, of course, the proverbial frog soup. But unlike the frog, we don't have any place to jump off of. So we humans are imperiled, and it would behoove us to start recognizing that and to talk about this problem with the unprecedented number of fish that are dying due to the record heat and drought across the country, especially the Midwest section. We're going to bring in now Todd Polacek, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about this and what we can expect more of. Todd is a limnologist at Applied Ecological Services, and I'm not even sure I know what a limnologist is, but I bet you can tell us. Todd, welcome to the Green Front.
Right, very good. Thank you so much for having me. A limnologist is a is an ologist. It's someone that studies the surface water interaction, and that is how lakes cycle nutrients and how fish and aquatic invertebrates come into play.
And are we just now, you know, seeing something that was unexpected, or have you experts been, you know, anticipating this as climate change, you know, rears its ugly head in terms of, you know, we talk about, you know, warmer temperatures, surface temperatures in the oceans, but hadn't really thought about, you know, ponds and creeks and rivers and all the places where, of course, fish live and need the temperature to be stable and the whole ecosystem in the water. And apparently water temperatures have reached 97 to even 100 degrees in some places. How can we expect that to not have an impact?
Right. Okay. So the first part of the question, you've got a couple of questions there. But the first part of the question was, are we thinking about this in the context of surface water? And listeners should know that this is a natural phenomena to have fish kills from time to time. I'll talk a little bit about how it has typically occurred, but what's quite unnatural is the scope and breadth and depth of that which is occurring. And that is, to this magnitude and for this duration, there certainly are some connections we could make. Now, typically, within a typical year, I'm not sure if I can say what a typical hydrologic year looks like anymore, that anybody really can, after in southern Wisconsin we've endured 8 weeks, I think, or better, of unprecedented drought, probably the worst drought, I think they're saying, since 1988. And if people remember what happened, that was the year Yellowstone, of course, burned. But anyway, back to this. Typically, what happens is, in smaller bodies of water, smaller ponds and lakes that tend to have a lot of nutrients, or are warmer water systems, higher water temperature carries diminished oxygen. And another way to complicate and add to that is when we add a lot of nutrients, and we could talk a little bit more about land use. But as we add nutrients, we further take in heat to waterways, we take oxygen away. And what, in a typical year, what ends up happening is we will have some fish kills, but, you know, it typically occurs for, you know, maybe a week on select waterways every year. What's happened this year is that we've had mass die-off in a number of larger rivers, and unfortunately, the it tends to hit game fish and larger fish that have a higher respiratory demand much harder than it does some of the other fish like common carp that are adaptable to lower dissolved oxygen conditions.
Interesting, because one might think that the smaller fish are more vulnerable to this.
Right. I mean, it's almost a game of attrition for a lot of the, you know, sort of the bait fish and the minnows. But, you know, what the public often identifies with are, well, what we associate as CMF, charismatic megafauna, so game fish and things that anglers, sportsmen, and many folks can identify with, like, say, a largemouth bass. But in addition to that, there are a lot of other fish that are very important to the ecology of aquatic systems that are hit very hard as well, like sturgeon, catfish, and a lot of the minnow species.
I understand this from this article that so many fish died in one Illinois lake alone that the carcasses clogged an intake screen near a power plant, lowering water levels to the point that the station had to shut down one of its generators. This is exactly the kind of thing that just, you know, it's a domino effect of climate change, is it not?
Right, and I think, you know, I always think about it sort of in terms of the cost accounting, and we're not always using whole cost accounting when we when we make land use decisions, especially those that operate those land use decisions that directly impact our surface water, and that would be a clear example. Who knows what they're spending on cleaning up of those carcasses, or what they'll have to do to, you know, lost revenue for a beach, for instance. I don't know of that particular instance, but there's a number of stories coming about. But think of the old Aldo Leopold quote, and that is, a surface water is merely a reflection of the land use. And that's a pretty powerful statement if you think about, you know, the early 70s Clean Water Act intent was to make all waters of the U.S. swimmable, fishable, and drinkable. So, you know, I always ask myself that question as well. Like, how are we doing? Boy, we can get all these things right, but not this.
And given that however all this incredible, you know, intricate, interrelated ecosystem we call nature, the web of life, our life support system, however it got here, how dare we destroy it in such a relatively short amount of time, and especially when we are no longer ignorant? I mean, are you as outraged as some of us are that this is happening before our very eyes, and we're hearing unprecedented this, unprecedented that, and yet it still seems like it's pretty much business as usual if you look at our political system, you know, business. Yes, some businesses are starting to be more sustainable, but it's incremental, not in real, you know, ratio to the extent of the, you know, enormous catastrophes plural, that are unfolding.
Right, and we're much more attuned, both government, scientists, agencies, regulators, and in many cases, private entities sort of leading the way of having a better, taking better inventory and understanding this better, but then also making wise land use decisions. I could say I'm outraged. I try to channel my passion, my energy into doing something about this that's meaningful, and that's how it's blended into our business model. And that is, think about this, like, take a step back and look in a greater context. So, you know, when Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring in 1962, and in the 60s, you know, it was a real call to arms, because we had pipes dumping sewage in the river, right? We had the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in 1969. I think the Detroit River did as well that year. So if you take a step back, we're much more progressive in many ways in understanding it. It's so big, though, and it, meaning policy and interpretation and how to infuse a lot of these elements to inform wise land use decisions that won't sting business. And will be easier for government people to regulate and to foster the good players, so to speak, and also punish those that aren't compliant. And you know, I think that business and wise land use decisions aren't mutually exclusive, and we can talk a little bit about that too.
If we have time, I'd love to. If not, we'll have you back, because this is a, you know, increasingly important area of concern and focus. But I have a question. We talk a lot on this show about ocean acidification and dead zones. Do we see the same effect in ponds and lakes and enclosed bodies of water on a smaller scale, or is that specific to seawater?
No, we certainly do. And all you have to do is see the effects of siltation. Look at some of our flowages, in Wisconsin, all around, those areas called flowages where there's a dam on a river. Those dams that we use for hydropower and sometimes for flood control create a lot of problems. And a lot of times, if they don't have outright dead zones, what they will have is areas that get close to being anoxic, and that is it doesn't carry enough oxygen for all the problems that I stated earlier. And they'll have just diminished biodiversity. You'll have an increase in generalist feeder fish and pollution-tolerant aquatic insects and various things. For instance, mosquitoes are relatively pollution very pollution tolerant type of aquatic life. They can complete some species of mosquitoes can complete the entire life cycle in the hoofprint of a cow. Okay, but they can deal with terrible hot conditions, diminish oxygen because they breathe from an atmospheric tube. So what we have to do is be very in tune with those canary in the coal mine bio indicators that tell us where some of these problems are. And flowages are just one example. Anywhere you're near a lot of heavy agricultural and industrial use, you can have some of those anoxic zones that are not in the ocean, but they're in freshwater environments.
What does your company do?
We
applied ecological services.
Right, we do. Our mission is to bring the science of ecology to all land use decisions. And so what we do is we focus very closely on restoration ecology, and we apply that to dispersed stormwater, alternative stormwater approaches, bioswales, rain gardens, river restorations that not only benefit humans but also benefit aquatic life. Through restoration practices. We apply that to the urban environment. We can apply it to the suburban environment. We work on mines, on landfills, and some pretty unlikely places where you wouldn't think how would you bring ecology into some of these environments? I'm always amazed, but it's an amazing company.
Well, and what's so tricky is, you know, nature is so complex and we don't even understand fully how it all works, that we're tugging on one end of the web, if you will. There's always some unraveling, some of it seen, some of it not seen, at least until perhaps, you know, some time lag, significant in some cases. That's what's kind of frightening, isn't it? Because not all of this can be restored.
Right, yeah, that's a cause for much debate, right? What is restored? There are some areas that we can move towards rehabilitation, but we'll never be able to restore truly that ecological function that Mother Nature took millions of years to create, and that we took a mere 50 years or 100 years or several hundred to destroy, dismantle.
And maybe fewer when it comes to climate change impacts, since we're just beginning now to feel the full effects.
Right, and that's the game changer. You know, as we sit and tinker in our models right now, whether they're certified floodplain managers and engineers working on where is that 100-year floodplain map, there's no such thing as really a consistent hydrologic year. to aquatic ecologists and other land use professionals, how within our models, how can we even account for climate change? It's really a game changer.
And, absolutely.
And to your point, Betsy, the challenge is the consequences of our actions are pushed so far beyond our knowledge of our actions that it's very difficult to connect the dots.
Well, you'd think that we would be treating it as if it's a multiple crisis, as of course it is, and we'll be talking more about this impact. Todd Polacek, thanks so much for joining me, especially on short notice. Wanted to get this hot off the press as soon as your report came out. A limnologist, now I know what that is, at Applied Ecological Services. That does it for this edition of The Green Front. If you joined us partway, please go to prn.fm to hear the whole show, or my website, which is thegreenfront.com. Hope you enjoyed the program. Please tell your friends and family and even your enemies about it. This stuff is for everybody, at least those of us who eat, breathe, or drink. I want to thank Matt Bogart back in the PRN studios in New York for bringing this show together at the last minute in some cases, some of the elements, and also everyone else behind the scenes at PRN. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, have a great green one, and stay cool if you're in one of the areas hit continually by heat and drought.